is Joakim Noah, and you're listening to Chicago Bullseye.
Give it all you got, take your very best shot, and may the best team win. The time is now, the name of the game is action. They're on the floor, and they're ready to score, so let the game begin.
NBA historian, basketball historian Tim Gallagher joins Chicago Bullseye. Tim, it's great to have you on in these fantastic celebration of the Bulls Summer League title. You know, I couldn't help but thinking of your comments in the last episode when Valentine hit that last second game winner, where you were talking about he had a lot of those one-on-one games and those unique type of shots where he was able to create for himself. And I kind of I recalled that comment that you had in the previous visit to the Bullseye. I kind of felt that way on that last shot. Looked very reminiscent of what you were describing.
Exactly, and that's something I noticed about him early on in the summer league, and you know, saw him in person a little bit, and then watched all the rest of the games on television. And when I see guys that have those kind of improvisational moves, right, or able to improvise like that. But, you know, those are things in just an up and down, you know, AAU type game where you're not really forced to come up with something too creative, you know, meaning that if you're in a half court set or you're playing 2-on-2 or 3-on-3, you know, which is kind of a lost art these days to see players with those kind of moves. So I noticed that right away with Denzel, and even at Michigan State too. I noticed he had some little one-handed shots where he'd get in the lane or he'd shot fake and do a dribble and get and not just layup range, you know, 8 to 10 feet, you know, one-hand shots and things like that. So I don't know for a fact, but I would just guess he played a lot of one-on-one with his dad, who was, you know, a big guy and a former college player at Michigan State. So I'm just guessing that, you know, playing against older, bigger guys, you have to come up with creative ways to score. And in one-on-one games or playing in the driveway kind of thing. So he obviously has that. And just overall, he really just knows how to play and seems to have a lot of fun playing and just the way he shares the ball and moves the ball around. So I think he's going to be a real fun addition to this Bulls team.
You know, what's so impressive to me about Valentine in that game, he really had a poor game up until – you know, that fourth quarter at the end, really. He didn't shoot the ball well at all. But it's a great sign, I think, when you see a guy like that. And I've been comparing him to Paul Pierce. I think he's got a lot of Paul Pierce-ish qualities about him. And, you know, obviously I think his ceiling is a lot higher than most. I think most would probably say right now he's going to be a good role player in the NBA. I really feel like this guy could be an all-star, make multiple all-star teams. And he just has excellent court vision. He does so many things well offensively. Defensively, you know, obviously he's got some limitations, but, you know, Paul Pierce is a good example of a guy who wasn't an ultra athlete who still was able to be a very, you know, excellent performer on the NBA court. And then you see that quality, which is so rare, I think, for guys, which is when you read the reviews of the game or the story of the game, get me the ball, I want the ball, I want to take the last shot, be fearless in making those shots, and then it actually coming through twice. In a game that I think its importance is, you know, probably most people would understate it as a summer league game. But let's be honest, it was Tim versus the Bulls, and there was a lot on the line there. I felt I know Minnesota really wanted to win that game. What say you?
I agree, and you know, the fact that he wanted the ball and has that kind of confidence really seems kind of unfazed, right? Where he hadn't been shooting the ball well, but at crunch time he was willing to take the shot. And, you know, I guess the way you could look at it is he's not afraid to win the game, I guess the other side of that, he's not afraid to lose the game either, right? You want those players that have that kind of confidence. And obviously he's played ball his whole life. He's been around the game, been exposed to it, had great coaching at Michigan State with Izzo. So when you factor in all the ingredients, I just am very excited about him as a pick with the Bulls, and I can see him as a rotation guy. He also just seems like a great teammate. And you notice even the guys that have been in the program a while, right, or guys that have been in the league, you know, Grant and Portis, Dinwiddie, Felizio, they all seem to love playing with him, right? There was some real good chemistry on that team. And, You know, I think one of the favorite things I read about Denzel when, you know, sure, it's just summer league and you can kind of laugh about it, but hey, the Bulls did what they had to do. They swept the summer league and won the championship. And I saw a quote from Denzel that he said, people that say it's only summer league, that's coming from those people who didn't win summer league.
I love that. I saw it too.
Fantastic. I thought that was, and that's just a great mindset, right? And why not go out and try to win all of them, right? And I think with the young core of players that the Bulls used in the summer league, it's important to develop that winning culture. You heard Pete Myers interviewed, and he mentioned that several times, and his meetings with Hoiberg once the season ended, and they were looking ahead to the future, and these young guys is just to really change the culture and build a winning culture with these young players. And, you know, and when you look at it, you know, certainly the college players, Felicio didn't play U.S. college basketball, but the other guys are all from very successful college programs and, you know, had winning teams, played in the NCAA tournament. So I think all that definitely matters. And, yeah, and so it was great to see, again, Denzel. I mean, who would have thought the game tying shot and then the game winning shot and then, you know, asking for the ball, give it to me and let's get out of here kind of thing. I just love that. And, you know, and Portis was pretty dominant in the summer league, made the all summer league team and, you know, very close to a double double. I think he was just under 10 rebounds and averaged, I want to say 18 a game. Grant was MVP of the championship game. And I think he showed a real, knack for being able to run the team and also mix in some athleticism. And also he's got some of those kind of unique shots as well. Those little runners or he finds gaps or seams and then I thought Dinwiddie was one of the pleasant surprises of summer league overall. I mentioned that in the last podcast, and he continued to play well throughout. And I don't know if I still haven't seen that they've signed him or what his contract situation is, but you heard the broadcast.
I soured on Dinwiddie when he missed those two free throws at the end of the game. I just saw something at the end of the game which really soured me on him. I can't stand it when guys just choke at the end in a game that's really meaningless in the big picture. It doesn't give you a good, as soon as I saw him miss those two free throws that were really key in the last minute, I said, oh, this is why we were able to get him for a bump, like, you know, for Cameron Bearstow. And to me, Grant separated himself in that last game. I do have concerns about Grant's jumper, though. I thought his jumper was atrocious for the most of the games that I saw. And that's something he better develop because he's not physically dominant enough to be able to play this game in the NBA game without that. What say you?
Right. Yeah, it definitely needs some development. We talked about that early on, too, in terms of the shooting for him. And you know, that was disappointing with Dinwiddie, but I thought his overall body of work was really good in the summer. And listening to the broadcasts on ESPN and NBA TV, I know that John Barry was speaking very, he was very high on Dinwiddie and, you know, very confident that there's a place in the league for him. Now, whether it would be with the Bulls or somebody else, I don't know. And I'm not saying he's a starter or anything, but as a, you know, in the Bulls situation, if he does make it as a third point guard, you know, I would be fine with that. You know, Felicio seemed to do a good job. You know, a couple other guys that we could at least give a quick shout out to as well on the Bulls Summer League roster were Tez Wells and Jack Cooley. I don't know if they're going to make the roster or a roster, but they both played well at times. And I think Cooley's just a little too undersized. You know, he played at Notre Dame and has bounced around the D League and I think had a cup of coffee with maybe the Jazz or someone last year. And having seen him play in person in college as well as in the NBA, summer league, he's just a relentless rebounder and hustle player. It's just he's a little undersized for a five and just doesn't have the skill set to be a four. So that's why a guy like him who plays with that kind of passion and heart and looks like he'd be a great teammate, but he's just, you know, either doesn't have the size or skill set to be the four or five that you want. And then Des Wells, you know, I mean, there's guys like him that, you know, he had a nice college career at Xavier and then finished up at Maryland. So he's been in some winning programs and played some high-level college basketball. And, you know, with the right opportunity. You know, could he be a Brandon Rush and Alonzo G, PJ Tucker, you know, that kind of a player with the Bulls or with the league, you know, possibly. And, you know, so we'll see how things shake out with the roster. But overall, nice to celebrate the Summer League title. We'll take it.
Absolutely. I don't know if you saw any clips, Jimmy, in the moving on now to the All-USA, the USA team. I saw some video of Jimmy just absolutely dominating the scrimmage here in the USA team. I think this is really good for him. I just feel like when you're playing it with these players of the caliber that he is on a day-to-day basis in the summer, it could be nothing but, it could be, you know, nothing but good things for him to see how the other guys prepare, how they work, learn, you know, maybe learn a few parts, little bits and pieces, you know, pick up from other players on this team. What do you think of the guys on the team overall? And number two, do you agree with me that this is good for Jimmy?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, for the Bulls in general, to have Jimmy there, of course, and being around, you know, Carmelo Anthony and Kevin Durant and some of the, you know, the elite players of the league and players that have played in international competition before, you know, and just that he's in that mix, right? So, and I know if people hadn't withdrawn or been injured from what the maybe ideal USA team roster might have been, you know, Jimmy was probably on the bubble of making that. But, hey, he's there, and I think to build on that and to be around that kind of coaching and those kind of teammates, you know, some of the most elite players in the world, of course, it's going to do a lot for him. And, again, as he's, you know, side-by-side with Wade as a – you know, kind of the junior alpha dog with Wade as the senior alpha dog on that team. I think it's great. And then the fact that the USA Select group that's working out with them and scrimmaging with them includes McDermott and Denzel Valentine is going to be a great experience for them as well. And in fact, you know, the fact that the USA basketball committee thinks enough of those guys to have them in the mix, especially Denzel being such a young player, you know, and McDermott obviously kind of plays with a style that I think would be good for, you know, Euro ball, you'd say, or Olympic ball with the shorter 3-point line and, you know, and the skill set that he would bring to the table with a team like that. So, you know, the roster, because of some of the injuries and guys are withdrawing for various reasons, you know, the roster to me was a little bit underwhelming. And again, I'm not a huge DeAndre Jordan fan or DeMarcus Cousins fan. I've mentioned that number of times on past podcasts. So I just hope with DeMarcus Cousins, he'll be on his best behavior and won't create some sort of international incident in the Olympics. But I would assume with Coach K and the teammates he's with, he's going to be on his best behavior. I was thinking of the analogy of him being with the Kings as kind of, you know, a bratty kid that knows they can get away with it because they're not, you know, they've got the upper hand, right? Either with parents that are in over their heads or whatever, right? So Cousins, you know, the Kings, unfortunately, kind of enabled some of this poor behavior, you know, with everything from things he tweets to, you know, to blow-ups on the court that, you know, kind of derails, you know, otherwise, you know, an impressive skill set. So, you know, obviously, I think the roster is going to be enough to win gold in Brazil, but, you know, again, the roster isn't as you know, ideal as what we could potentially see with, you know, obviously Curry and LeBron would be the two, you know, that immediately come to mind. But give some of these other guys like Jimmy a chance to step up and get some great experience and see what they can do on a bigger stage.
Love to get your opinion on also now the passing of Nate Thurmond, who was a former Bull. He was a part of actually a big trade, I believe, in mid-70s from Golden State to the Bulls. I'd like to get your opinion on him as a player. Tell our audience a little bit about Nate Thurmond.
Sure. Well, Nate was a legendary Hall of Fame, top 50 all-time player that most of his career was with the Warriors, initially San Francisco Warriors, and became Golden State Warriors, and then played for the Bulls and the Cavs later in his career. And, you know, pretty much was on winning teams the whole time. And, right, was in that Clifford Ray trade, which actually, you know, got the Warriors a championship shortly after that deal was made. And, you know, Nate had gotten the Warriors to the finals two different times. In 64, when he actually played forward, you know, he was known more as a center, but the Warriors had Wilt Chamberlain at the time. And Nate was brought in as a power forward, was drafted as a power forward. They ended up trading Chamberlain, and then Nate moved into the middle at center and was a longtime center then for the Warriors. And, you know, with those credentials that I mentioned, then in 67, they also got to the finals with Rick Barry. And unfortunately, Rick Barry, shortly after that, jumped to the ABA. He was, which is a whole other topic we can pursue someday, but some players with the ABA being formed, you know, there were some bidding wars then for certain players, and there really wasn't free agency. And long story short, Rick Barry jumped and was gone from the Warriors from 68 to 72, which was part of certainly the prime of his career, which I was thinking back.
I never knew that.
Who did
he play with in the ABA?
Well, a couple of different teams, but he initially jumped to the Oakland Oaks, which were obviously right there in the Bay Area where he was already playing for the San Francisco Warriors. And the coach of the Oakland Oaks was a guy named Bruce Hale, who was an NBA pioneer player and coach, and at the time was Rick Barry's father-in-law. So his mother, Pam Hale, who's the mother of John Barry, Brent Barry, Drew Barry, you know, Scooter Barry that played at Kansas. You know, he has one other son now, but there's a different mom for her. He has a son now that's playing in college basketball. So, and then the NBA blocked it. It was, you know, went to the courts. And so basically he had to sit out a year before he was eligible to play. But Barry, he had a run there in the ABA and had some success. But if he would have stayed with the Warriors and with Thurmond, you know, that team was right on the brink of, you know, of getting to some finals. They did in 67, with Barry and Thurmond leading the way. But
in 67, then they lost to Wilt, right? For Wilt's only title outside. We did one with the Lakers. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, that was the Sixers team that was at the time had set the record for most wins in a season. So it was Wilt, Chet Walker, who later, of course, went to the Bulls and had some great years. Billy Cunningham, Hal Greer, you know, among others. But that was the Sixers team that won it. But anyway, back to Nate. The other interesting note: in 1965, he had 42 rebounds in a game. Which, kind of jumps off the page. You know, the other thing about Nate Thurmond is he's the greatest player ever from my college, my university. So I went to Bowling Green University, and that's where Nate went to school. He's originally from Akron, Ohio, and went to Bowling Green. And I read up on it, and you'd think a guy of his size and talent would have gone to Ohio State. But at the time, Jerry Lucas was already at Ohio State, and Jerry Lucas was and is still considered one of the all-time great players in Ohio high school history, at Ohio State history, and so Nate was concerned about playing time or even playing and getting in the lineup with Lucas, so he opted to go to Bowling Green, where he had a lot of success there, and actually, to tie this back to some Chicago and Illinois related news, again, I did a little more research, and of course, going to Bowling Green and in the gym, they had, you know, framed photos of all the legendary players at Bowling Green. And, of course, Nate, even way back then, was certainly one of those people. And in 1963, Bowling Green played the eventual NCAA champions, Loyola Chicago, during the regular season. They played them in February and beat them 92-75. So basically blew out the team that was the eventual NCAA champs. And unfortunately, Bowling Green was beaten in the NCAA tournament by Illinois. They lost by 3 to Illinois. And if they would have beaten Illinois and the other bracket would have worked out as it did, they would have had a rematch with Loyola Chicago in the NCAA tournament and, you know, might have gotten, you know, an NCAA title because they'd beaten Loyola pretty handily. But Illinois nipped them in the tournament, so they never got that rematch in the tournament. But that was certainly Nate and probably Bowling Green's greatest moment as a college basketball team to this day.
Fascinating stuff there, Tim. I mean, just incredible knowledge here. One thing I did want to jump to really quick was when Nate came to the Bulls. So a little history lesson for listeners. The Bulls used to be in the Western Conference. I believe in the early 70s, the famous team that they had with Jerry Sloan and Bob Love and, you know, all the classics, all the great guys.
that team lost the Lakers, I think, a couple years in a row. I think they lost to Milwaukee one year. But their best chance of getting finally to the title was the year that Nate Thurman was actually traded to the Bulls from the Warriors. And I think they were up 3-2 in the Western Conference Finals going to Chicago. Lost Game 6 and then went back to Golden State and lost Game 7. Is that correct? Do you recall this?
That is correct. And you might recall we talked about the Warriors on a podcast last year when the Warriors won in 2015 because that was the 40-year anniversary of when they won in 75. And we talked about how the Bulls and some of our discussions about Sloan and where the Bulls were right there. I mean, you know, a game away from getting to the finals. And ironically, you know, Clifford Ray, a former Bull, was holding down the center spot for Golden State. And then Nate was more of a backup to Tom Bullwinkle on that team, but he was on that team. And so you're absolutely right.
He was past his prime then, though, right? Is that right? I mean, he's pretty
old. He was. Yeah, well, he came in the league in the 63-64 season. So, yeah, so he would have been, you know, more than a 10-year veteran by that point. And so, yeah, certainly past his prime, although still a very effective player. The other little bit of trivia with Nate and the Bulls is he recorded the first quadruple-double ever recorded in NBA history. With the Bulls, and there's a little bit of an asterisk to that because block shots were not kept as an official statistic until I believe it was the 73-74 season. So I'm sure there were probably games where Wilt or Baylor or you know Oscar or somebody, I don't know if Oscar would have blocked more than 10 shots in a game, but I'm guessing it might have been done before then, but block shots were not an official stat. So according to the record book, and when they officially kept those stats, so yes, so it was points, rebounds, assists, and block shots. You know, I guess steals would be another valid statistic now. But so Nate holds a unique distinction of being the first person in an NBA game to officially, with officially underlined there, record a triple double.
Incredible. One thing about too, I do recall back to that Bulls Warriors series in the Western Conference Finals. I talked to Bob Love about this, right? I remember reading in a history book where after the series, the controversy was, did Dick Motta overplay his team? Because Bob Love averaged an insane amount of minutes. I think he almost played like every minute of the game. And he had a guard, Rick Barry. And it was a quote from him where he was saying, yeah, I was tired. I had to go through screen after screen, all over Barry on one end and still perform on the other end. It was just an interesting throwback to Tom Thibodeau, you know, from Motta to Thibodeau, both old school guys who ran a couple of their key players in the ground, some would argue, mainly me. And I just thought that was fascinating to read that quote. So, interesting tie-in with Nate Thurman with the Warriors and Bulls and NBA history here.
Right. Well, and you think of the, you know, I didn't look it up in a book, but just off the top of my head, you know, the centers, the Hall of Fame centers and the styles of play that he had to play against during his time in the league, which again started in 63 and ended in, you know, in the mid 70s. But you know, you had Russell, Chamberlain, Kareem,
Jabbar,
Bob Lanier, Dave Cowens, Walt Bellamy, Willis Reed, Bob McAdoo, Elvin Hayes, Wes Unseld. So, you know, there weren't that many teams either. I mean, I probably named almost half the teams, right? So he didn't have very many easy nights. And you see quotes from Kareem that, you know, any time he scored or had a good game against Nate Thurman, he knew he'd really earned something. Because Nate was a physically menacing player. I mean, he's a gentleman off the court. But, you know, just I remember one of the early NBA games I ever saw in person was the San Francisco Warriors at the Cincinnati Royals, and Nate Thurman was playing and just had not really seen someone with that size and strength, you know, with just bulging muscles and shoulders and just, you know, never seen anything quite like him. And then I remember after the game when we were just little kids at the time, and, you know, I was almost kind of scared to approach him to get an autograph after the game and just remember what a gentleman he was, which, you know, I tried to reconcile in my mind, God, this was this mean, nasty guy in the court, and now he's he's being so friendly. So it was a fun memory as I was thinking back on Nate and his career.
You know, to wrap it up, I'd like to ask you a question. I know we didn't talk about this pre-show, but I'd like to get your opinion. As someone, you know, my memories of basketball watching NBA go back to, you know, pretty much the mid-'80s, right? That's how far I go back. But in my mind, I've always kind of, based on conversations I've had with, you know, NBA fans and my dad and et cetera and other people who watch the game, it sounded like from the 60s and 70s, offenses were basically geared at getting the ball to the big man down low. It was really a center-orientated game. Whereas, obviously, now, I mean, how many great centers are there in the game? You can count on one hand, if that, or half a hand. You know, what do you think? Is that true? Would you agree with that assessment that the games in the 60s and 70s were pretty much geared, and the offense was geared, get the ball down low to a big man and work off on that, getting shots, high percentage shots down low, or is that a misnomer?
No, that's absolutely true. And it was kind of both the mindset of coaches at the time, and remember there was no three-point line, you know, for a lot of that time. And so the approach to the game was really more of an inside-out game, right? So establish the post game, establish being able to score down in the block, and that will force the defense to have to sag and help on the big man, and then that will then open up shots on the perimeter, right? So that was the way the game was played then, and the mindset of coaches and how people played. And where today, I would say it's more of an outside-in game, right, where you don't have real dominant post scorers. You know, even people like Dwight Howard or DeAndre Jordan, you know, are not really skilled post scorers. Cousins, I would say, he has some interesting moves and can score down in the block. But, you know, as we've seen, you know, with small ball and just the way Cleveland really didn't, you know, play Mozgov at all, right? And Bogut, you know, rarely scored. I know he was injured for the last few games of the finals, but, you know, you never saw the Warriors throw the ball down into the block to Bogut and say, okay, let's see what you got with a, you know,
exactly,
a hook shot or a drop step.
I mean, just think of the mid-'80s, Kevin McHale, you know, Kevin McHale had a fantastic back-to-the-basket game, post-game. How many guys have that now? And if they do, it's usually like a guy like LeBron or maybe a three. You know, or two. I can't think of any centers that, like, I just throw it down to him on the block and, you know, something great's going to happen. Even Gasol, who I always felt had an excellent post game, you know, he was primarily utilized on the perimeter to take advantage of his jump shot.
Right, right. Well, and some of those players I mentioned that Thurman would have played against, you know, a lot of them were traditional low post guys, obviously, Chamberlain, Kareem, Bob Lanier, you know, Walt Bellamy. But then others like Dave Cowens, Bob McAdoo, those guys were kind of more like how the style of game is played today, where, you know, they were not, you know, 7 foot plus centers. Well, I didn't even mention Bill Walton's name in that group too, where he would have overlapped a little bit with Thurman. Kind of Walton's first few years would have been Thurman's last, and he was definitely a low post guy. But kind of how the game is played today for a lot of teams is when you think of the Celtics with Cowens, where he was an undersized center, and so he would play more at the high post and try to make players like Wilt and Kareem come out and guard him, right? And
interesting, yeah.
But, yeah, definitely it was more of a post-oriented game and, you know, down on the block and, you know, hook shots and drop steps and, you know, you know, Kevin McHale kind of moves. I mean, you know, McHale was one of the great greats of all time in terms of post moves and footwork and things like that. But, you know, the kind of style that he played with in the blocks and the Celtics were what all, you know, almost all big men in that era you were mentioning, you know, the 60s, 70s were really striving for and into the 80s.
Great stuff, Tim. I can't thank you enough for joining the Bullseye again. And your knowledge is just unsurpassed, man. I love having you on to hear the stories. I think we need to do more of this over the next 30, 60 days. I'd like to get a little bit into
you know, basketball history for the fan base. And if you're listening, you have any questions you'd like to ask him, feel free to email us at ChicagoBullseye@gmail.com, and I'm sure you'd be happy to answer him on the show as far as history of the NBA. Why don't we get a little bit into that over the next couple months?
That would be great, Fred. Yeah, now that we've got a little bit of a breather now that the summer league's over and got the Olympics, of course. But, yeah, there'll be some fun topics to talk about throughout the summer. And, again, it was a lot of fun to see the Bulls take care of business in the summer league and see Denzel emerge with some game winners.
Sounds good, my man. Hey, great talking again, Tim. Have a great one, and talk to you again soon, okay?
Sounds great, Fred.